Welcome back. You're listening to Cross the Border. This is our Prophecy Reality Edition. And this segment, we're going to continue going through the history of apocalyptic interpretation by E.B. Eliot. And this is our Reformation Quincentennial Edition. Hope everyone's enjoying this series as we go through it. When we left off, last time we left off in period 6, that is 1610, to the French Revolution, and our third expositor of that period was Dr. Kressner. Giraud's English contemporary, during the reigns of Charles II and James II just ended, a mighty change had overcome the spirit of the dream, at least among the ministers and adherents of the established Church of England, from that which had rested on the minds and dictated the acts of the founders and chief ornaments of that church in the century of the Reformation. The religion of Rome had become not only fashionable at court, but the religion covertly or avowedly of the reigning kings themselves. Moreover, the sufferings of the episcopal clergy during the 15 years ascendancy of Cromwell and the Puritans had tended to make them look on the latter as their nearest and principal enemy, and, by a consequence not unnatural, to regard popery with less of disfavor, and sometimes even with the thought and desire for friendly approximation and union. This feeling could not have its effect on the current view of the prophecies in Daniel and the Revelation, which had been hitherto, by the reformers, like German, Swiss, and English, applied undoubtedly to the Roman popedom, by the celebrated Dutch scholar and politician Grotius, and by our English Dr. Hammond, a preterist view was adopted of the apocalyptic prophecy about the beast in his great city Babylon, very like Alcazar's, referring it all to the old pagan Roman city and empire. Dr. Kressner himself, writing in the year 1690, strongly speaks of the change, and tells moreover how the very study of those prophecies had in consequence fallen into disfavor. His own book, which was first published in 1690, and is dedicated to the Queen Mary, then reigning with her consort William of Orange, is entitled A Demonstration of the First Principles of the Protestant Applications of the Revelation, and well answers to its title. Its one grand subject is the apocalyptic beast of Revelation 13 and 17. And in a series of connected propositions, he incontrovertibly establishes against Alcazar and Bellarmine that the apocalyptic Babylon is not pagan Rome, as it existed under the old pagan emperors, nor Rome paganized at the end of the world, as Ribera and Malvenda would have it to be, but papal Rome, as existing from the 6th century. For he argues, it is Rome idolatrous and anti-Christian, as connected with the beast or Roman Empire in its last form, or under its last head, which last head is the 7th head revived, after its deadly wound, with a sword, and under which the beast exists all through the time of the old empire into the 10 kingdoms, until Christ's second coming to take the kingdom. The 6th, or imperial ruling head, in St. John's time, must, he argues, have fallen at the latest at the time at the Herulian chief, Odoacer, and Ostrogoth king, Theodoric, reigning in the 5th century, and he concludes that the 7th head was the Heruli and Ostrogoth, which continued but a short time, the 8th being the revived secular imperial confederated with the Roman ecclesiastical head, somewhat as under the old emperors, i.e. the secular Western emperors combined with the popes, and he suggests Justinian's era as that of the commencement of the last head. That's very well advanced for 1690. He has the right ideas, but he still doesn't leave room for the future. But the future came nonetheless. The image of the beast he makes to be the Roman Church, the name Latianos, in the Greek there. The death of the two witnesses caused by the beast, he explains, after Giraud, as probably occurring after at the revocation of the Edict of Nantes and the nearly contemporary expulsion of the Waldenses. Altogether, Kreschner's book must be regarded as an important accession to the Protestant cause and Protestant argument against the Romanists. On to our fourth expositor of the era, Bossuet. The apocalyptic comment of this Roman Catholic prelate deserves more attention from us, as being written by one who is, I believe, confessedly the ablest as well as the most eloquent of the controversialists on the papal side, and written by him deliberately and avowedly in order to wrest out of the hands of Protestants a weapon used so often and so powerfully by them against his church. And when, in 1685, just after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, M. Giraud, one of the exiled French Calvinist ministers, had published that work on the apocalyptic prophecy, of which we have just given an abstract, the Bishop of Meaux thought it well to take up the matter and to apply his great talents to the drawing up of an exposition such as might be comfortable with the dogmas and requirements of the Romish faith, and sufficiently strong and solid, so he expected, to withstand the criticism of Protestants. I now proceed to give a sketch of it. It is framed very much more on Alcazar's plan, and that of Grotius and Hammond, who had followed Alcazar on that of the preterists, not Ribera's of the futurists. The grand subject of the prophecy he conceives to be the triumph of Christianity over Judaism and paganism, i.e. over paganism as established by the Roman Empire, and in the Jewish part with reference only to the latter calamities of the Jews, not to the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus. For as Bossuet judged the revelation to have been written under Domitian, that destruction by Titus had happened, in his opinion, before the giving of the revelation. The details are as follows. The six first seals exhibit the subject in the general. There is first Christ moving forth as a conqueror, and then, in the second, third, and fourth seals, his judgments of war, famine, and pestilence on the enemies of Christianity. Then, in the fifth seal, persecutions of Christians and the reasons of God's delay of judgments, till the number of his martyrs be completed and his elect taken out from the infidels, wherever they might be hid. Further, in the sixth, a picture of political convulsion and revolution applicable, first, to the overthrow of the Jewish people, secondly, to that of the Roman Empire, thirdly, to what the others might be considered in a manner typical of, that is, the general judgment, then to particulars. After an illustration of the seventh chapter of what was said to seal five of the cause of the delay of God's judgment, by representation of the sealing of such as were elect unto salvation among the Jews, and also of the salvation of the Gentile martyrs innumerable from out of the empire of pagan Rome, the first four trumpets, according to Bossuet, thus depicted the progress of God's judgments against the Jews. Trumpet 1 showed the primary victory over the Jews by Trajan. Trumpet 2, the victories over them by Adrian. Trumpet 3, and following its following star, the impostor Barcocabus, son of a star, declaring himself the Messiah, and so stirring up his countrymen to war. Trumpet 4, the obscuration of the scriptures, especially of the prophetic scriptures, which were as luminaries to the Jews by the compilation of their Talmud, the subjects particularly obscured being Christ, who is the sun, and the church, the moon, and in all which trumpets, the third part spoken of as affected, meant that not all the Jews would be killed, not all the light extinguished, etc. And then the subject passed from the Jews, the fifth trumpet being one of transition from Jews to Jewish heresies and errors. For in the fifth trumpet, the scorpion locusts were Judaizing heresies introduced into the Christian church about 196 AD. Soon after Adrian's destruction of the Jews by Theodotus of Byzantium and continued on towards Artemon and Paul of Samosata, the heresies concerning the Trinity and Christ's divinity, the commission not to kill, but only to torment, showing that this plague was not one of invading warrior foes. About AD 260 or 70, this woe passed away. The Council of Antioch, AD 264, ending it. Then, just at that time, Trumpet 6 exhibited the woe of an invading enemy of horsemen from the Euphrates, the Persians, who, after a while, overthrew and took captive the Emperor Valerian. In Revelation 10, Bossuet, like Mede, makes the little book a prophecy, but only as the remainder of that of the seven-sealed book, after the sixth trumpet, the contents being developed in the chapters following. Thus, in Revelation 11, after the measuring of the temple or church by St. John, indicating that whatever violence of persecution there was, a temple they could not destroy. We have then first a general view of Christ's witnesses and martyrs during the persecutions of pagan Rome. Some, for example, that of the Emperor Valerian, lasting about 3.5 years, though that particular term of time, or its equivalent, 42 months, was used rather by borrowing from the history of the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes, or the drought under Elias, besides signifying a certain limit of time ordained by God to one and all of them. Next, and when the witnesses should have finished their testimony under pagan Rome, there's a prophecy of Diocletian's persecution of them, Diocletian the beast from the abyss, and temporary suppression of the Christian worship, and in the great city of Rome and the Roman Empire, followed, however, quickly by a figuration of the revival under Constantine, the tenth of the great city falling, and 7,000 slain, figurative of the overthrow of the pagan emperors and forces, and the song in heaven on the seventh trumpet sounding, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ, having reference to the establishment of Christianity then effected in the Roman Empire. A more particular figuration of which and of its consequences followed in the next chapter. For the male child of the travailing woman, or church, was Constantine, and other Christian emperors succeeding him, the war of the dragon against the woman before her childbirth being that of the Diocletian persecution, the war in heaven immediately afterwards, that which ended in the fall of paganism under Galerius and Maxentius, the floods cast out of the dragon's mouth when the woman was fleeing to the desert, that of Maximin, and the dragon's next war against the remnant of the woman's seed, that of Licinius against Constantine. Then in Revelation 13 came the figuring of the revival, as it were, of Diocletian, the beast that had killed the witnesses, in the apostate Julian, though the sixth head, wounded to death, was Maximin, the second beast with two lamb-like horns, figuring Julian's pagan priests and philosophers, pretending to miracles and moral maxims like those of Christianity. The image of the beast, images of pagan gods made to speak oracles, and by the pagan priesthood, while the beast's name and number, here we see Bossuet refers to the original, not the revived beast, was Diocles Augustus. Then in Revelation 14, the prophecy proceeds to announce the fall of Rome and of the Roman Empire through the Gothic invasion. The harvest judgment is that by Alaric, the vintage that by Attila. The vials trace out the same subject more particularly and as beginning from an earlier date. The Greek of the first vial was the great plague in the time of Valerian and Gallienus, the Second vial figured the bleeding empire as if dead. The third, the civil wars and 30 tyrants. The fourth, the drought and famine of that period commemorated by Cyprian. The fifth, Valerian's defeat by the Persians. The sixth, the drying up of the Euphratian barrier and opening of a passage into the empire from the kings of the east, i.e. the Persians, the frogs, the magicians, etc., who urged Valerian to his fated Armageddon, i.e. the field of battle where he was captured by the Persians, the seventh, on the air with its earthquake and hail, the capture of Rome by Alaric. It's kind of neat how he puts everything, makes everything preterist, and puts it into the past before the division of the Roman Empire into 10. So going on, yet again, this Catholic expositor, Revelation 17, reveals other important points in this subject more in detail. The beast's seven heads were Diocletian, Galerius, Maximian, Constantius, and Chlorus, the four emperors. In those joint names, the first edict of persecution went forth, together with Maxentius, Maximin, and Licinius, three persecuting emperors afterwards added. At the precise time to which the vision related, A.D. 312, five of these had fallen, vis-a-vis the first mentioned four and Maxentius. One was, vis-a-vis Maximin, Licinius the seventh had not yet come, i.e. as a persecuting emperor. It was further said the eighth king is of the seven and goeth to perdition. This was Maximian, who was of the original four, but had abdicated and then become emperor again. Julian is not here brought forward by Bousset. Further in this chapter, Revelation 27, 16 and 17, there was a very striking prophecy about the ten horns on the beast. They were to give their power to the beast till the words of God were fulfilled, yet to hate the harlot and tear her. So were the Goths, Vandals, etc., long admitted as soldiers into the Roman armies and as allies into the Roman territory. Does not Bousset make here the beast to be Rome? Yet did they afterwards tear and desolate the woman, i.e. ravage Rome and its empire. The millennium, Bousset explains, as the period of the church's supremacy until Antichrist's short reign on Satan's loosing near the end of the world, the new heavens, new earth, and new Jerusalem as figures of the saints' heavenly glory. So that was the counter-reformation ideas of a Catholic expositor. And I guess we're going to pick up there when we get back from these messages. You're listening to Cross the Border, Prophecy Reality Edition, and we are going through the history of apocalyptic interpretation. Quite enlightened to see the development of the interpretation of prophecy. We'll be back in a few minutes.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on satellite, internet, or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe, so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Visit crosstheborder.org, C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of Nicholas Arthur's new book titled When the Third Temple is Built. That's crosstheborder.org. When it comes to prophecy today, much of the evangelical Christian world has their eyes on Israel, waiting and watching to see when the third temple will begin to be built. The plans are drawn. The Jewish people are eager. Most evangelical Christians today believe that the rapture will happen before the third temple is built. Hi, I'm Michael Eugene. I was taught that Daniel's 70th week was in the future. Is that really what the Bible teaches? Have we searched the scriptures and found this to be true? Why is it so important for a re-established Israel to build a third temple in Jerusalem? Is it necessary to build a temple on the same location already occupied by the Dome of the Rock? Is it necessary for sacrifices to take place in the temple on Temple Mount? Is there really a rapture followed by 7 years of tribulation? What is the New Testament temple? Can we identify history and prophecy? Who is the first beast in Revelation chapter 13? Who are the seven kings in Revelation 17? I have asked all these questions, and I have found Nicholas Arthur's new book, When the Third Temple is Built, answers all these questions and more using Scripture to interpret Scripture. The Bible says that no prophecy of Scripture is of any private interpretation. Nicholas shows us in his new book, When the Third Temple is Built, how the Bible interprets prophecy and not man's private interpretation. Visit crosstheborder.org, C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of Nicholas Arthur's new book titled When the Third Temple is Built. That's crosstheborder.org.
Welcome back. You're listening Across the Border, our Prophecy Reality Edition, and we're going through the history of apocalyptic interpretation. And we've gotten to period 6 in the book, and that is 1610 to the French Revolution. I believe there's 7 periods in this book, if I'm not mistaken. Let me see. Let me look at this table of contents. Yes, 6 periods. Yes, 7 periods, and the last one, which will be coming up, is the French Revolution to the present time. And but really the present time is about 1860 in this book, because this is written by E.B. Eliot and was published about 1862. So there's no really updating to do on this book. This is, you'll get it pretty much as he wrote it, except for maybe some typo and corrections and a little bit of update in grammar and language, but that's about it. So this is like an original work, and we've published this here, and you can get that by going to my website and following the links to buy books there if you want, or you can get a copy, a PDF for free by clicking on the free ebook tab there at crosstheborder.org. Or my blog, which is nicholasarthur.wordpress.com, and follow the instructions on that free ebook tab, and then ask for History of Apocalyptic Interpretation or whatever book you would like. But you have to ask for it; otherwise, I will send you The Rapture or will be canceled, which is a good choice too. See, the nature of the historicist method of interpretation is such that the line of fulfilled prophecy is continually moving with the passage of time. And you can see that as we go through these eras, these 7 eras in this book. And I guess we'd have to add an 8th era to go from 1860 to present, right? But we haven't done that. That's what we talk about daily when we do shows specifically on prophecy here. But you can see how the line of interpretation moves with time. And ever since the beginning, it seems that the church has had this idea that the return of Christ was imminent. People did not understand what year it was from creation. But I've done I've done a study. It's on my website. It's called What Year Is It? It's also in my book here, When the Third Temple is Built, as an appendix. But you go to my website, you get a nice full-color, very readable exhibits, like you see in this book. There are exhibits, but they're much more readable on the website. That's What Year Is It? But they pull a timeline out of the scripture, and they give us a timeline that leads us to the idea, by evidence, that the seventh millennium will begin about the year 2055. I don't know exactly, give or take a year there. Not really that important, but it's important to know approximately where we are in the 6,000 years, in the 6,000th, the last millennium, which we are near the end of, leading up to the seventh millennium. Okay? So we see that's about 2055 that we will be at the turn of the millennium and likely the return of Jesus. I don't know what day, month, hour, or even really what year, but I can tell you it's going to be around there somewhere. And you can check out my work for yourself. Go to my website, crosstheborder.org, and put in the search box there on the website, What Year Is It? And you'll find that study, and you can go through it, verify it for yourself by going through the scriptures, read the comments there. Many questions you might come up with are probably already there in the comments. This has been up there for I don't know how many years. That post has been up there, but quite a while. Let me see if I can figure that one out there. How many years has it been? Usually trending, but if you go to crosstheborder.org, hit the homepage button there, which says crosstheborder.org, and there it is. I'll show that to you. Right there on the website. Just go to crosstheborder.org, or as I said, nicholasarthur.wordpress.com, and there's a link to it. It says, What Year Is It? And if you go to that, you'll see that we first published that in 2013, and many, many updates to it, but I'm at the point where I really can't refine it anymore. So I think it's been thoroughly vetted by the listeners, critics, and adherents alike. So do check that out. There are 99 comments there that you can peruse and give you a little more, a lot of enlightening questions, comments, and otherwise there for your edification. But there it is. Okay. All right, we're going to jump back into History of Apocalyptic Interpretation and continue where we left off. We were with, what's the name of this expositor? Vatringa, expositor number 5. And we'll just start here again. He was theological professor in the Academy of Franeker for many years till his death in 1722. And from that petty Dutch town near the mouth of the Zuider Zee sent forth those masterly and learned works on Isaiah and the Revelation, which have always been regarded as placing him on a high rank among biblical expositors. His apocalyptic commentary was first published at Franeker A.D. 1705. My notices of it in the body of the Horae Apocalypticae are frequent, says the author. Like the seven epistles, the seven seals and seven trumpets, though not the seven vials, were deemed by him to be representations of the successive states and fortunes of the Christian Church from St. John's time to the consummation, with reference, however, not to the same, but to very different eras in the respective seminaries. The scheme above will best exhibit to the eye the mutual relations in time and subject. It will be seen that though the main subject of the seals is made by him, the external state of the church, that of the trumpets, the fortunes of the Roman world, connected with the church, yet they sometimes essentially infringe so as might have been anticipated on each other. The third seal, the example, has the Arian heresy for the main part of its subject, and also the third trumpet. The fourth seal refers to the desolations of Greek Christendom by the Saracens and Turks, and so the sixth trumpet. Having elsewhere referred to his epistles and seals, let me here only add an observation or two on his trumpets. It seems to me that first, that his Gothic reference of the fifth trumpet was that which very much fixed his general scheme of the trumpets. Meade's chronological application of the 5 months or 150 years period of the emblematic locusts to designate the Saracens' latest and feeblest ravages justly appeared to Vitringa untenable. And moreover, he had any satisfactory solution of the locusts not touching the grass and the trees appeared in Meade's Saracen view. But the Gothic ravages, from Alaric to Tautilus, did not last nearly 150 years. And if the grass and trees were figuratively construed to mean Christians, professing Christians, then Alaric sparing the Christian churches at Rome and those who took refuge in them might be supposed. Vitringa thought a sufficient and obvious explanation on the Gothic view of that clause also, which being so, he evidently rests with much confidence on the solution of his fifth trumpet, more so than on almost any part of his trumpet scheme. And this point settled, what preceded the Gothic invasion must, of course, be ascribed to the trumpets previous, what followed to those subsequent. So the Saracens, as well as the Turks, were crowded necessarily into the sixth trumpet, yet not without obvious difficulties and inconsistency. For example, in this Gothic application of the fifth trumpet, Vitringa explains the locust hair being like women's hair with reference to the personal appearance of the Goth's yellow hair, though certainly this was no feminine characteristic among Jews, Greeks, or Romans. But the faces of men he felt unable to explain of personal appearance, and so fell back on the moral characteristic, one surely scarce applicable to the Goths of humanity. Second, as regards the third part, six or seven times noted in the first four trumpets, he suggests that it might perhaps be intended of one of the three continents of the Roman Empire, and so explains it of the Eastern or Asiatic third in some of the trumpets, yet in the fourth trumpet of the Western region, and sometimes too rather as meeting some notable part. Moreover, after throwing out an idea in the first trumpet that the land might be meant distinctly of the Roman Empire, the sea of the barbarians construes land, sea, and rivers all alike of Roman Christendom, mainly in a figurative sense, sometimes like Meade. In Revelation 10, Vitringa so far follows Meade as to make the little book open a prophetic section, not, so as earlier reformers, the open Bible or New Testament. The special subject, however, of the new prophecy, herein differing from Meade, being part, he thinks, of the seven-sealed book, he expounds of the increased corruptions of the church and the rise, power, and persecuting acts of the beast in Western Christendom, contemporarily with the Turkish woe of the sixth trumpet, the seven thunders being signified of the seven crusades, the charge thou must prophesy again of the prophetic knowledge imparted to and taught by Christian ministers under the sixth trumpet, the witnesses prophesying in sackcloth, one grand part of the new prophecy, of the anti-papal testimony from Peter Valdez to the Reformation, their 42 months or 3.5 years being perhaps, so as Scaliger had suggested, on the scale of a year for a century. As to the witnesses' prefigured death and resurrection, it had been already partially fulfilled in the four cases following. One, in the death of Huss and Jerome, and their revival in the Hussites immediately afterwards, about the time of the 3.5 year session of the Council of Constance. Two, in the massacre of the Waldenses' remnant, in the valleys of Cabrera's and Marindal, AD 1545. 3, in the anti-Protestant interim of Charles V and Prince Maurice's quickly following victory and consequent treaty of Passau. 4, in the massacre by St. Bartholomew and the edict of toleration obtained from Henry III within 4 years after. Vitringa notices Giraud's views also, calculating the slaughter of the witnesses from the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, or some other persecuting act following it up, which view, however, had not so far been verified by any such rising of the witnesses or Protestant revolution in France as Giraud had expected. And on the whole, Vitringa, inclined to look to the prophecy as being one up to his own time, still mainly unfulfilled. I may observe that he considered that the tenth part of the great city, which fell concurrently with the two witnesses' ascent, ought to be construed to mean one of the 10 kingdoms of papal Christendom. Which being so, how was it that the fall of papal England did not fix itself more deeply in his mind as an indication of the intent of the whole prophecy? After this, and the witnesses' political ascent, Vitringa expected that the six trumpets' Turkish woe, in the which all about the rainbow crowns, angels' descent, and witnesses' death and resurrection had been included, would cease, and the sounding of the seventh trumpet introduced God's judgment on the enemies of the church and the blessed times predicted by all the prophets. In Revelation 12, the vision of the dragon and woman is expounded. One, of Diocletian's persecutions, followed by Constantine's establishment of Christianity, the dragon's seven heads, like those of the beast symbolizing both Rome's seven hills and the seven persecuting emperors of that period, Diocletian and etc. Such is his view of the illusion of the clause, and they are seven kings. Two, and the Arian persecutions of Orthodox Christians after the fall of paganism, both explanations very much as in my horror. But the wildernesses into which the woman then fled, Vitringa makes otherwise to mean the barbarous nations of the West, and the waters cast by the dragon after the woman, the Saracen inundation, swallowed up in France on occasions of the victory of Charles Martel. In Revelation 13, after a somewhat elaborate notice and refutation of Bossuet's explanation of the first beast, agreeably with certain Protestants as meaning Rome pagan, Vitringa interprets it of Rome papal, its seven heads, however, not including heads of the old Roman Empire as well as of papal Rome, as had been generally thought by Protestants, but only heads of its last papal form. So he makes the five first to be the five most eminent popes before the Reformation era being the point of time in which the angel's words five have fallen is to be referred, vis-a-vis Gregory VII, Alexander III, wounded by the death to Fred Barbarossa, but soon revived, Innocent III, Boniface VIII, the beast's middle head, and John 22, the sixth and seventh being two popes after the Reformation, vis-a-vis Paul III and Paul V, while the eighth and last was the one that would be ruling at Rome at the time yet future of the last persecution. The second beast, Vitringa explains, after many of the old as well as the then more recent expositors, to signify papal preachers and doctors, especially the Franciscans and Dominicans, the beast's image as the tribunals of the Inquisition, of the beast's name and number, Latianos, was deemed by him almost too simple a solution, and he progresses some strange, far-fetched Hebrew phrases from Scripture, which it is not worthwhile to repeat. I pass here to Revelation 14. Here, the 144,000 are explained of the Waldenses and Albigenses. The harpers next noted as sympathizing with the 144,000 of the Wycliffites and Hussites, the first flying angel that had the everlasting gospel of Luther, Zwingli, and the other fathers of the Reformation, the second of the Reformers' voice of triumph over Popedom at the times of the Treaty of Passau, in the second period of the Reformation and the disruption of the English Church from Rome, the third of the Protestant doctors in the third period of the Reformation, at the time of affliction to Christ's Church, such as even then partially existed, especially with reference to France and the French Reformed churches. In entering on the vials in Revelation 16, Vetringa acknowledges the plausibility of Lanius's opinion that these vials are all contained in and the development of the seventh trumpet. Lanius, having noted, one, that these were the last plagues, and the seventh trumpet the last in finishing woe, two, the fact of the temple, the heavenly temple, says Lanius, in the same sense of heavenly as when applied to the heavenly Jerusalem, appearing opened introductorily to their effusion, just as it was described in Revelation 11:19, as appearing at the sounding of the seventh trumpet. Three, answering on the view to the type of the seven compassing of Jericho on the seventh day, besides that, fourthly, Lanius, though the fifth vial on the seat of the beast looked very much like the blow on the papacy at the Reformation. But Vetringa could not make up his mind to suppose all these vials, if not six, as already fulfilled in certain judgments on the popedom. Thus, the first, that of the grievous sores appearing, he traces in the Waldensian exposure of the deep corruption of the papacy. The second, that of the sea beast, the sea becoming blood in the bloody wars between the emperors and the popes, more especially from the times of Frederick II and Louis of Bavaria. The third, that of the rivers of blood in the Hussite and Bohemian wars under Zeiza, etc. And the fourth, on the sun, the regal emblem, in the great heat with which two French kings, Charles VIII and Louis XII, had scorched Italy. The fifth, on the seal of the beast, in the darkening of the popedom by the Reformation, and the taking and sack of Rome by the Constable Bourbon. In the sixth vial, Vetringa curiously explains the Euphrates drying up in the exhaustion of the power of France as the chief bulwark of the papal Roman Empire, an event perhaps even then begun by the banishment of its multitude of industrious Protestant citizens at the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. In the three frogs issuing forth contemporaneously, he supposes to mean the Jesuits, expounds the seventh vial on the air as typifying the dissolution of both the political and the ecclesiastical papal empire. On the apocalyptic millennium, Vetringa adopts a view that had just before the first time been propounded by his contemporary Whitby, to whom indeed he refers, an alternative view to the two between which opinions had been hitherto divided, of the greatest importance, vis-à-vis the old Kiliastic of the earliest fathers, and the Augustinian, a view which regarded it as a spiritual millennium yet future, one in which the world would be thoroughly evangelized, and the church, the bride, assume a character over the whole earth, answering to the description of the New Jerusalem. On the whole, Vetringa seems to be by no means to have contributed directly to the solution of many previously remaining difficulties of the Revelation, so much as from his ability and various learning one might have anticipated. Indeed, his explanations are often singularly arbitrary and unsatisfactory. Intellectually, however, the value of his commentary has doubtless been considerable, illustrating each subject handled, as he does, by a widening ranging erudition alike in secular and ecclesiastical, Hebraic and Greek literature, often applying and adopted by expositors of note before him. And that is all we have time for today. You've been listening to Cross the Border, our Prophecy Reality Edition. And next time, we'll come back and we'll go to our sixth expositor of that era. That will be DeBoz. We'll see you then.
The book of Revelation says, "The spirit of prophecy is the testimony of Jesus Christ." This is at the very heart of FirstAmendmentRadio.com. In that spirit, we have created the Prophecy Reality News app for all of your mobile devices, streaming First Amendment Radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, available for your Apple, Android device, and smartphone absolutely free. Get the Prophecy Reality News app installed today so you can listen to First Amendment Radio wherever you are. The Prophecy Reality News app. Get it now.